Welcome to the Mike Fave Podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Wright, joined by Mike Fave. On this podcast, Mike and I help you make sense of the online health chaos while answering your individual questions along the way. So if you have any health trends, topics, or questions you'd like to see us discuss in future episodes, please leave them in the comments below and we'd be happy to get them answered. In today's episode, we are going to dive into fasting and discuss Dr. Mindy Pelz's comments on fasting and weight loss, Dr. Berg's thoughts on fasting and cortisol, Dr. Rhonda Patrick's comments on fasting and protein intake, and lastly, Dr. Peter Attia's stance shift on fasting after losing significant amounts of lean muscle mass. So fasting is one of those things that when you begin your journey into the alternative health sphere, whether you're trying to solve gut issues or lose weight, it is one of the top strategies that I think people try. So I know I have my own personal experience in dabbling and fasting and different sort of time restricted eating patterns. And Mike, I know you've spoken about on other podcasts sort of the same. So do you want to briefly touch on maybe your experience with that?
That's a good segue in because I don't think that a lot of people who find us from the low carb spheres realize that like at one point I was also low carb and I was doing intermittent fasting and keto together. I basically did the fasting stuff and the keto stuff for over a year, like religiously, a combination of doing both simultaneously. And I think that there's a couple of things I ran into. So one, when I did do the fasting, I got extremely lean, but I was way too lean. I was like 6% body fat. So I'd gone to participate in a research study on the university campus. And one of the studies was testing like different ways to gauge body fat percentage. And so they were doing hydrostatic weighing versus bioelectrical impedance versus like different forms of body fat percentage estimation. And so I had enrolled in the study and I mainly because I wanted to see what my body fat percentage was, but also to support science, you know?
Oh, right. Of course.
And basically what during that time I was doing the keto and intermittent fasting together and I was 6% body fat. And while I looked really lean and, you know, I looked good from like a leanness perspective, I also had a lot of problems. So my workout recovery was terrible. Like I was not recovering well. I wasn't progressing in the gym. I also was having issues with sleep. And then I was also running into issues with stress and mood. So like I was constantly on edge while I was doing the fasting and having the low carbohydrate dieting. But some other things that while I was fasting had improved. So like I did have the morning mental clarity with fasting and it did help with my digestion quite a bit. So I got quite lean, probably too lean. My digestion was a bit better with the fasting. And I did have mental clarity benefits, especially compared to the other diet that I was doing before I did all this, which is like a bodybuilding diet. So my cognition was better when I went low carb and fasting and digestion improved. But then I ran into the stress problems, the sleep, the exercise performance, the mood. Now, unfortunately, I didn't have the money at this time to like check all my blood panels for different elements. I had to go through the university doctor and basically they weren't going to run labs on anything. So I didn't really get blood work done at that point in time. But I did have like there was pros and there was cons of running the fasting. And I think a lot of people wind up running into these circumstances with the fasting and with ketosis long term.
Yeah.
It has some benefits in some areas and then it has some cons in some other areas. And I think the proponents of it online speak about it as if it's only benefits. And then they don't kind of get into the nitty gritty of what are the potential cons and what are the potential downsides. And so I think that's what we're going to get into here today is kind of talk about some of the cons and provide some balance to the perspective that I think is lacking in the spheres.
And many of the people who were once proponents of it have now kind of shifted their stance and acknowledged the problems with it. But I just know like when I was doing the fasting, I paired it with like low carb, which is kind of what you see. And then also just insane amounts of training too, like basketball for 2 hours, then go weightlift, then go sit in the sauna for an hour. And then like after that, my day was over. Like I was dead. I would just sleep partly because like if you are fasting, you have to slam so much food in such a short amount of time. So I end up relying on like crappy keto treats or protein bars with all the additives and polyunsaturated fats too that were just wrecking me digestively. So I was really not experiencing any benefits. I mean, for the people who, I guess the weight loss thing is huge, but I was slamming enough calories to try to not lose a bunch of weight. But yeah, that was my experience.
I mean, I think how you set these things up is exceptionally important and it will make a difference in what the outcome is for you. But that's for every single intervention. And I also think we'll see here that you don't need to fast to lose weight or to improve body composition or to improve metabolic parameters. Like you could just set the diet up appropriately. So for me, I think I got the benefits because I systematically tested out a 6 hour versus an 8 hour eating window versus like a 4 hour eating window. So it was like, wake up in the morning, I would cook all my food though, so that I was ready to go for the day. And I have my first meal at 12, and then I have my next meal at 7. So like it'd be 12 to 8. So that would take me an hour roughly to eat from 7 to 8. So it'd be like 12:47 or 12:337. And I would plan it so that I could get all the calories in, because I was tracking a chronometer. And I also realized like I couldn't get, if I didn't have my like 3 square meals, like if I tried to just do it in 2, I was making up for the lack of calories with like just the same thing that you were, just like literally just spooning butter. Like days I'd miss meals, I just spoon butter because I couldn't eat that much protein. And then I also was eating a lot of greens to try to get in enough micros, because I couldn't get them in on the food sources that I was using when I was trying to keep my carbohydrate intake less than 30 grams a day. So it was like, there was a lot of like very specific interventions and like adjustments I had to do, because I was trying to hit my micros. I was trying to like get all the calories in. And it, I think it did, like doing that did give me benefits, especially compared to what I was doing before, which like this bodybuilding setup. Because there's tons of things in bodybuilding that I was eating that I wasn't tolerating. But if I like into your points, when I had missed meals because of exams or training or whatever, it would really throw me off and I could not get enough calories and I'd wind up slamming things and I would feel terrible. And I would be so full from all the food. I would put myself into a food coma from all the food. So things like this. So if you do it, it has to be done appropriately. And now that's what, you know, Dr. Rhonda Patrick is going to talk about on one of these clips. But there's also other problems with it that I think also led for me to have issues with sleep, with mood, with ability to put on lean muscle tissue, with ability to produce gains in the gym, like actually make progress in the gym. The only other thing I'd say is that I would extend, a lot of times I wanted to extend my fasting window because my clarity was best when I wasn't eating mentally. And so that led to problems as well. Cause then like, that's why I tried to do shorter fasting windows than the 8 hour, but then I started to have other problems. Like certain things got worse. And cause I can't tolerate coffee. I'm a slow metabolizer and it gives me problems. So basically, there's definitely pitfalls with everything. It's not all, you know, all roses. There's problems with each, and we're going to get into that right now. So we'll start with our dear friend, Mindy, Dr. Mindy Pels, and then we'll run from there. So here's her clip telling us about fasting as a weight loss helper.
Let's use what the classic thing somebody does when they go to lose weight is they restrict what they eat and then they exercise a bunch. All of that is just trying to manipulate the sugar burner system. The only way you get over the fat burning system is through fasting. Taking what those good habits that you have around food, those amazing habits you have around exercise, and I just want you to pair it to a fasting length. So it's anywhere from 12 hours to 72 hours. That's where you start to see more fat being burned permanently. So diet and exercise won't work alone, but if you pair them with a fasting window, they're going to work a lot better.
So I don't know. This was the same lady who was saying like fasting raises testosterone. I think we talked about this. Like we think it was just a mistake. She said it raises it like some ridiculous amount, which it's like in the research, it does not raise it. Yeah, it doesn't. Fasting doesn't really raise testosterone to any significant extent inside the research. So that's not true. And then even the things that she's saying here are like fundamentally also not true. So I don't know what she's talking about with the sugar burner system versus the fat burner system, but like you don't have to fast, first of all, to get into fat burning. Like it's not a requirement. So,
yeah. Or to lose weight. Like she says,
exactly.
Yeah. She's like, you know, if the diet doesn't work, if the exercise doesn't work, that's because you're not pairing it with fasting. I would say like, if the diet isn't working and the exercise isn't working, let's take a look maybe at those things before we add like another stressful element to the setup.
Well, the research is clear on that. There's no differences between time-restricted feeding or fasting regimens and weight loss, insulin sensitivity, and then also effects on fatty liver and even inflammatory markers and things like this. So it's like not even, like it's just not true. Like it's not a true statement that like this whole sugar burner, fat burner thing, like this dichotomy she's creating isn't reality, because we're always oxidizing both carbs and fats. It's just a matter of how much we're oxidizing, and how much carb and fat you put in your diet will shift that regardless. If you have metabolic dysfunction, then you're not oxidizing anything well. Like you're likely not oxidizing fats super well, nor are you oxidizing carbs very well. And there's a whole host of other things going on there. But like just for people who want to lose weight, you're oxidizing carbs and fats all the time. Now, not at an individual cell, but across the whole body, different cells will be using different fuels. at the same time. And when you take in fuels, prioritization of fuels will shift. So that's like, you don't have to fast to get into fat burning. That's a myth. That's not true, at least from what we see in the research. Then the next thing is, I have studies here basically showing, and I'll pull them up for us here. I'm going to share my screen. We found that people may lose more weight by intermittent fasting than by usual eating. So meaning just eating whatever they were doing over 3 months, but not when compared against energy restriction diets for 3 months or longer. So 3 to 12 months. So basically, if you just restrict your energy, it's the fasting outcomes, like the caloric restriction and fasting have the same outcome on weight. There's like no difference overall. The next thing they say is, we also found that intermittent fasting did not appear to affect blood sugar levels when compared against usual eating over 3 months, energy restricted diets over 3 months, or energy restricted diets over 3 to 12 months. So this study I'm quoting is a systematic review from Cochrane, which is one of like the like highest tier research groups that you could look at research from. And essentially what they're showing is that there's not really a difference on blood glucose levels or weight loss from normal eating, from caloric restriction, like just like eating a little bit less each day and whatever 10%, 20%, whatever the different percentage are, if they're calorically matched, versus intermittent fasting. So we're not really seeing any significant difference here between the two. So you don't need to fast to lose weight. So what she said there fundamentally isn't true. You can still just do, if you want to lose weight, set up appropriate deficit, you'll still lose weight. Now, there was one study, and I pull this up because I've had people reach out to me before about this study and say, see, intermittent fasting is actually better. And so this study is titled Differential Effects of Alternate Day Fasting Versus Daily Caloric Restriction on Insulin Resistance. And so what people try to prove here is that, well, fasting actually improves insulin resistance. And so what they say in this paper, they say in insulin-resistant subjects, weight loss was not different between alternate day fasting and caloric restriction by month 12 relative to controls. We see caloric restriction in this right-hand side and in the alternate day in this left-hand side, alternate day fasting. And the alternate day fasting and the caloric restriction groups were not calorically matched. So basically, in the alternate day fasting, on month 6, so you have month 6, the feast day, the day where they were able to eat, is an alternate day fast. People had 1,400 calories. And then on their fast day, they had 1,049 calories, right? So they're between the days, they're having roughly 1,200 calories on average. Whereas in the caloric restriction model, by month 6, we're having 1,700 calories a day. Then we get to month 12, the feast day was 1,700 calories and the fast day was 1,100 calories. Whereas on month 12, the caloric restriction, the caloric intake was 1,700 calories. So what you're seeing is this is the daily intake. And then people are alternating between 1,763 calories and 1,175 calories. So their average intake of calories is lower overall than the calorically restricted group. So the question is, was fasting this magical remedy that improved people's insulin sensitivity, or the people in the fasting regimen just eating less? And basically it's like, it looks like they were just eating less overall with the fasting regimens. So I still wouldn't say that there's a massive change in the metrics. Like we see that from Cochrane, and then even in the studies that are citing the changes, we're seeing that there's some confounding elements inside the way the study was set up that may have created some of the result, and it wasn't necessarily due to fasting. Now, the last one I want to show here, the last quote I want to read, study is titled Effects of Time-Restricted Eating on Non-Alcoholic Fatty Liver Disease, the TREATY FLD randomized clinical trial. So in this study, they say a total of 88 patients with obesity and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease were randomly assigned to time-restricted eating or daily caloric restriction. The intrahepatic triglyceride content was reduced by 8.3% in the time-restricted eating group and 8.1% in the daily caloric restriction group at six-month assessment. The intrahepatic triglyceride content, so intrahepatic triglycerides, or the liver fat content, was reduced by 6.9% in the time-restricted eating group and 7.9% in the daily caloric restrictive group at 12-month assessment. Changes in intrahepatic content, triglyceride content, were comparable between the two groups at 6 months and 12 months. In addition, liver stiffness, body weight, and metabolic risk factors were significantly and comparably reduced in both groups. So whether you're trying to lose, like minimize fatty liver, whether you're trying to lose weight, whether you're trying to improve insulin sensitivity, there's nothing magical about fasting versus caloric restriction. And there's other things to talk about here with setting it up. So I don't know where she's getting this idea that you need to fast to get these outcomes, because that's not really what we're seeing inside the literature. And even Cochrane is saying this.
It just reminds me of the whole low carb stuff where, like, you're not doing it like good enough, you know, like you're not doing enough stressful activities, like, to get the result that you're looking for. Like, even when you go, like, you start on keto and you're eating like some amount of vegetable or something with your meals, and it's like, I still don't feel great. Like, I don't know what's going on with keto stuff. Like, well, you have to cut out the vegetables, or like the banana that you had a month ago is giving you the symptom that you're experiencing now. And it's like, okay, so I've restricted a bunch of foods. I'm over exercising a ton. And now I have to do this fasting like protocol or whatever. It's like kind of gaslighting, it feels like, in a way, to be like, yeah, just keep pushing yourself down this hole.
The question is more, if you set up your diet and your exercise, you're not losing weight, then the question is like, let's take a look at that first and see how it's set up. Because even with your regimen with fasting and the training, like, even if we were to say, you were to say, Mike, look, I want to do this fasting stuff, I want to do this keto stuff, but I'm like crashed every day and I'm plowing through coffee, and like, we just look at what you're doing, it's like, there's things even in that, even if I don't agree that that's the best way to go about it, that could have been corrected, that you would have likely made you feel significantly better. So there's, I think with all of them, there's this tendency to go in this direction of like, just double down. And so there's definitely like a middle ground that makes sense for particular outcomes between them. And so that's, you know, that's the goal, to kind of merge that gap or bridge that gap here. But yeah, with Dr. Pell's stuff here, it's just like, the thing she's saying, like, she's setting up a dichotomy that doesn't even make sense, this sugar burning versus fat burning thing, and you have to fast to do that. And then the component that makes it worse is that if you do your diet and exercise stuff and you just throw a fast in there by skipping a meal or something like this, and then now you're eating less, like, sure, you'll lose weight, but what we're going to talk about in a second is that you're going to lose lean mass, like, and potentially a lot of lean mass. And she's even talking about 72-hour fasts, which we're going to get into after Dr. Berg's clip. But basically, like, they cause stress, like, they increase cortisol, and that's not a contentious statement. Like, that's known inside the research.
Yeah. And I think the thing with fasting is it mainly just brings people's awareness to their eating habits. And it makes it maybe easier to eat like lower calorie because of that. Whereas if you just kind of mindlessly go about your day and you eat, then you end up eating a surplus of calories. But if you're bringing intention towards like, all right, this is the window that I have, and you're having square meals, then it just kind of like selects for, or kind of just causes you to eat like a little bit less. And then that's really the benefit.
Say you want to lose weight and you set up an appropriate caloric restriction, calorically restricted in diet. Number one, if it has adequate protein and you're doing resistance training, you're not going to lose lean mass and you'll lose body fat. And we know in the research that like that occurs. Like, we have studies basically showing this, and I've seen it with clients time and time again, and has nothing to do with fasting. It's just, cognitively speaking, if you don't know how to set that up, then fasting is easier. Like, yeah, I just skip breakfast. It's like, oh, yeah, or I just don't eat one day. It's like, you'll lose weight. And the other thing is, you'll see metabolic parameters that are bad, like are not great. And people who are overweight or dealing with metabolic dysfunction, as they lose weight, they will improve. It just is fasting the best way to get there? And it's like, you know, from a risk versus reward ratio, if you know how to set things up appropriately, I don't think so. So there's not this need, like, it's not like you have to fast to get some of these benefits. It's like, you can do things in another way, minimizing the downsides, especially some of the longer fasts, like a 12-hour fast, whatever. Like, if you just don't eat from breakfast to dinner, or and it like winds up being like 10 or 12 hours, fine. But like, when you start going like one meal a day, and then you start going for, I'm not going to eat for like 10 days type of stuff. Like, we'll see here. I have a quote here. The paper is titled, "Is Muscle and Protein Loss Relevant in Long-Term Fasting in Healthy Men? A Prospective Trial on Physiologic Adaptations." So this paper was done in 2021. And so they stay here that they took healthy men and they fasted them for 10 days. They gave them like 200, 250 calories a day. They say the 10-day fast decreased body weight by 7%. They say fat mass and lean soft tissue accounted for about 40% and 60% of weight loss respectively. So something to keep in mind is lean soft tissue on the 10-day fast accounted for 60% of weight loss. That is terrible. Like, that is the last thing that's the last ratio you want to have when you're trying to lose weight. I'd rather lose weight slower and just lose body fat. And so what they say is lean soft tissue loss was explained by reductions in extracellular water, 44%, muscle and liver glycogen and associated water, and in metabolically active lean tissue by 42%. So this is huge, because if you're losing metabolically active lean tissue, you are lowering your basal metabolic rate. And that's what they see here. BMR after a 10-day fast dropped by 12%. So just fasting for 10 days lowered BMR, basal metabolic rate, your metabolic rate, by 12%, and likely largely by dropping lean tissue, as well as negatively impacting hormonal profile. So this is why I think you see people like Peter Attia, and we'll see his clip here, say like, oh yeah, I stopped doing all this fasting because I like lost a bunch of lean mass. It's like, yeah, you're going to lose lean mass when you do this type of stuff. And we'll see with after Dr. Berg's clip, like it will negatively impact your hormones. So these things, like, we don't want to optimize for this. And if you can say like, I can set up an appropriate diet to lose weight, and that we talk about this here, like we talked about this in other videos, they say here this from this study, the main finding of the present meta-analysis was that caloric restricted resistance training prevents 93% of the lean body mass loss induced by caloric restriction, although it does not affect body mass and fat body mass reductions as compared to caloric restriction without resistance training. So basically you still lose fat mass and like you lose body mass and specifically fat mass in with caloric restriction and resistance training, but you don't lose lean mass. Like 93% of the lean body mass loss is prevented. And then we look over here, preservation of lean body mass with caloric restriction could also be obtained by additional protein intake. Longland and colleagues have shown that caloric restriction with resistance training with high protein consumption induces an increase in lean body mass and promotes larger fat loss if compared to caloric restriction with low protein consumption. So basically what we're seeing here is that you don't need to be on a fast. You probably would want to set up some degree of a deficit to take off body fat. It needs to be done appropriately. And then you want to make sure that you have some type of resistance training and protein intake on board. And you don't have to do this fat burner, sugar burner, like I need to do a fast on top of all that type of stuff. It's not going to make that much of a difference. The only benefit of the fast, like if it makes you stay on track more for weight loss. But besides that, like if you set up an appropriate diet, you will still get the outcomes. And if anything, it'll be better because if you're just fasting by skipping breakfast or skipping dinner, and then you're just eating less like of everything, then you're just going to lose lean tissue. And it's not like then when you're done with the fast, you're going to have less metabolically active tissue. You're going to have a lower basal metabolic rate. And now you're going to have to eat less altogether. Whereas I have clients right now who've lost over 100 pounds of body fat and have gained 15 pounds of lean mass in that same time frame. And it's by setting up the diet appropriately. And there was no fasting involved. It was appropriate diet set up. There was a caloric deficit. There's no way around that. On top of making sure micronutrients are covered, higher protein intake, and then he had appropriate resistance training set up. I have multiple clients who have, even women, who postmenopausal women, who have lost body fat and gained muscle mass through this same metric, and there was no fasting involved. They came from low carbon fasting backgrounds.
And that's what's disappointing, I think, for people who kind of realize the weight loss stuff and that they kind of crash, or the fasting stuff, and they crash their metabolism. Because now they realize like, oh man, I'm eating so little and still putting on weight. And it's because I participated in many of these stressful diets and strategies in order to lose the weight loss. And then to get it back, like you have to put back on the lean mass, like the metabolically active tissue that you lost. And so like even Peter Attia mentions that, like I stopped fasting and I said, no, I'm putting back on like the 16 to 20 pounds I lost like while I was fasting. And then you do get like the increase, like you're saying, in the BMR, right? So you can start to probably eat more as you put on that lean muscle mass and you change some of the hormonal profile and metabolic function, everything like that. But you kind of have to dig yourself out of maybe the hole that you put yourself in with all those strategies beforehand.
So basically the goal with the whole setup is you have adequate protein intake so that when your body starts to pull from its own tissues, fat tissue, glycogen storage, protein from muscle tissue, all this type of stuff. And if you have enough protein coming in the diet, well, it doesn't really have to pull from the muscle tissue anymore because it met its protein target. And then on top of that, if you have adequate carbohydrate coming in on a regular basis, then you don't really need to upregulate gluconeogenesis because you have the carbs coming in. So then what has to get pulled after that is the fat tissue. And the other thing is, even in keto diets, people are saying, oh, after the keto adaptation phase, which is roughly 3 weeks or so, what you start to see, and we're going to talk about that here, what you start to see is that when the body starts to use ketones instead of using carbohydrate, this is like the backup pathway. You start to use ketones, then you don't need to shred as much lean tissue. So it's a protective mechanism so that you don't have to shred your muscle mass to provide glucose for your central nervous system. Your body's like, all right, well, we have all this fat, so let's take some of these fatty acids and let's use these fatty acids as a substrate for the central nervous system, which cannot run on fat. So they have to convert the fat into ketones, and that will spare our lean muscle tissue. So you don't need to break down the muscle tissue to make glucose. So in both circumstances, in the keto setup, you are using ketones instead of glucose because you don't have glucose coming in. And in the carbohydrate setup, you are like having a higher protein, like a higher carbohydrate diet. You are having the carbohydrate coming in exogenously, so you don't have to make that carbohydrate from the breakdown of your own protein tissue. And in both states, you'll lose weight. There's some other, like we've talked about some of the other concerns with keto, and we'll talk about it here. In order to make ketones in general and to liberate all the fat tissue from your stores, you have to actually use stress hormones, adaptive hormones. Like it has to happen. There's no way that you're going to upregulate these things or that glycolysis, that release of fat without those components going on, and also have negative impacts on other hormonal systems. So this comes at a cost, but like that middle ground in between where you just like, you don't have the fat coming in and you're just like shredding your own, you're shredding your own tissues with like these fasting regimens. You don't have enough protein intake. And you're like, if you start losing lean tissue, like it's game over. Cause then by the time you're done and you take off all that lean tissue, your basal metabolic rate's going to be low. And as soon as you start eating normal again, you're going to start to gain body fat and you're going to start to put on weight. Unless you like really set it up appropriately. Whereas on the flip side, you take off the body fat, and then by the time you're done, you go back to maintenance calories and you're eating, even though say if your lean mass was 150 pounds and you lost 20 pounds, but your lean mass is still 150 pounds, your caloric intake when you're done can be the same as when you started because you have the same lean body mass. It's extremely important. That's why doing a fasting regimen set up poorly is a terrible idea for weight loss. Versus like having a reasonably set up diet with a resistance training program.
Yeah, and it has the negative effects on the hormonal profile like you talked about too, because you have to upregulate like those things in order to be able to pull from those stores.
Exactly. And this is a good segue because it brings us to our next clip with Dr. Berg, where we'll see you talk about hormones.
Can fasting mess with a woman's hormones? My physician says as soon as blood sugar drops noticeably, cortisol kicks in and it can further deplete a woman's progesterone levels. Thoughts?
You'll find that when you're fasting, you feel serene, calm, your stress goes down, your tolerance for stress goes up. What they're confusing is the counter-regulatory cortisol effect when blood sugars go down because you're not eating. But that's not going to be a big issue because as soon as your body starts adapting within 2 to 3 days and you start getting into ketosis, you're not eating sugar. So your body runs on fat fuel. So now you don't have this situation where you're just running on blood sugars and it goes down and then all of a sudden you can't tap in the fat. And then you have this issue. So the solution is to adapt to the ketogenic diet and your cortisol will be fine.
Oh boy.
I'm not even sure he really like addressed the question, right? Because he doesn't really mention like anything about progesterone. He's just like, it's going to be fine at the end.
he danced all over the place with that answer because the first part was like, once you fast, like you're going to be serene and you're going to feel less stressed. He's like, that wasn't the question, my friend. Let's just answer the first question this lady who asked this question. So basically, let's just talk about fasting first on the hormonal profile. And then what we'll do is we'll start to talk about the ketosis stuff on the hormonal profile.
He's basically saying that like the ketosis has to kick in, right? For the cortisol to not have the detrimental effect.
Well, that's basically, and we'll talk about that. That's what they show in keto diets. But a keto diet where you're eating every day on a regular basis, like enough calories, you just are not eating carbs, is different than going like just fasting. Because on a fasting, if you're just fasting, you're not eating at all, you have no food coming in, you have no fuel coming in. So all of the fuel that gets pulled from is from your own tissues. It's your glycogen stores first, and then you start breaking down your fat tissue and also your muscle tissue. And then eventually you'll start to break down mostly your fat tissue, but you'll also still continue to break down muscle tissue because ketones can't fully replace all the carbohydrate requirements that the brain needs. They can only replace a portion of them. So what winds up happening is, and again, like we'll see this, you have huge fasting proponents and Dr. Rhonda Patrick and Dr. Peter Attia basically saying like, yeah, I stopped extreme fasting regimens because I lost lean mass. So what they say here is they say, the first thing is that fasting will nuke thyroid hormone levels. Like it's known, like this is shown inside the research that it'll lower thyroid hormone levels. Now, people are like, well, my T3, like this is Dr. Judy Cho, my T4 and my TSH are fine. It's like, those aren't the hormones you're worried about on fasting. You're worried about your T3 values because what they say here is they say in humans, the T3 levels start to decrease rapidly after fasting. When measured during 80-hour fasting in healthy subjects, marked T3 and TSH reductions were observed within 48 hours from fasting onset. Another trial reported that serum T3 decreased up to 55% after 24 hours of fasting. Contrary to serum T3, TSH levels remained unchanged after fasting. Short-term 4-week and long-term more than 6-week alternate day fasting diets reduced circulating T3 without any change in TSH level. The same result was obtained from another 8-hour time-restricted feeding isocaloric ad libitum within the defined time study for 8 weeks. So basically, even on a time-restricted feeding study where people are allowed to eat as much as they want in the 8-hour eating window, they still see lower T3 values. So will fasting affect your hormones? But yeah, it'll affect your thyroid hormone in a way that's like really not that great. Like if your T4 is fine, your TSH is fine, who cares if your T3 is low and if reverse T3 is high? Because T4 and TSH don't actually have the major metabolic boosting, mitochondrial increasing, energy production increasing effects at the tissues that T3 does. So if your T3 drops, like you're basically, that is a direct indicator that metabolic rate is dropping. So not only are you losing lean mass, you'll also see a drop inside your metabolic rate from a hormonal perspective. So any claims around like, well, low carb or fasting doesn't affect thyroid because my T4 or TSH is fine, it's irrelevant. It's more what's going on with your T3 values. And even when I'm looking at a client's thyroid hormone panel, I'm saying, where's your free T3? Where's your total T3? Where's your reverse T3? And then also looking at T4 and TSH values.
And specifically for women, what do you see with their progesterone levels too? Like with the fast, how does the thyroid like relate to the progesterone?
So it depends on how the fasting is done, and it depends on the state of the woman. If the woman is obese or overweight and she fasts and loses body fat, it'll tend to improve hormonal markers in general. If the woman is like a leaner woman, like of a normal healthy weight, what will happen is in some women, it can mess up the pulsatile secretion of LH, luteinizing hormone, which is involved in regulating the menstrual cycle. So some women, if the fasting is done in too strong of a way, they can actually lose their cycle. And then in other women, it's like more, light fasting regimen. So you're just doing like a 16-8 or a 14-10. You probably won't see as much negative effect on the cycle unless you start to lose too much body weight doing that. But you will see a lowering of T3, and then the other thing that we'll see here is an increase in cortisol. But I just want to briefly mention this, how it lowers T3. So they say here, this might result, so this drop in T3 might result from the increased activity of type 3 deiodinase, which inactivates thyroid hormones. Contrary to primary hypothyroidism, in which both TRH and TSH are upregulated as a compensatory response, fasting decreases TRH and TSH levels. This is why you don't just look at TSH when you look at hormones. Because if you're coming out of low carb and fasting and your TSH is low, it doesn't mean your thyroid is working well. It just, these regimens themselves can lower TSH values, but also lower your T3 values by increasing. So type 3 deiodinase is the enzyme that basically metabolizes T3, like metabolizes it out. So like clears T3 out of the system. So you can increase your clearance of T3, and then you're lowering the stimulation of TSH from your pituitary gland on your thyroid to make more hormones. So it's an overall negative downregulation or like a drop of thyroid hormone function in these dynamics. So that's why you need to see a full, number one, why you need to see a full profile. And number two, this is really important to understand, is that with this stuff, it's not just what the hormones are doing in your serum. It's what's going on at the tissue level. How are your hormones responding to how is your cells responding to the hormone? And how is the metabolism of the hormone changing at the tissue levels? And here we're seeing at the tissue level would be type 3 deiodinase activity increasing, particularly at the liver, whereas we'll talk about with ketosis as well, changes in cortisol metabolism. So these are really important things to know about and understand, because if you go and say, oh yeah, my TSH got better when I went on when I did my intermittent fasting regimen, it's like, but my hands are always cold and I'm constipated and my feet are cold and my hair is falling out and whatever else. Like, that's not you, thyroid. And that doesn't mean that thyroid function is better unless you get a full panel and really see what's going on.
And it's not just women too, right? Like for guys, it'll crash their T3 thyroid profile, and then in turn, like androgenic function and everything too. I remember like, I never got labs for my androgens during like some of this stuff, but I remember being like, I don't think my testosterone's tippity-toppy.
Well, the thing is, in contrary to women, men actually do see decreased androgens from intermittent fasting. So like, it's pretty clear that men will see a drop in androgens from like fasting regimens, and the stronger they fast, the worse it gets.
And the more they exercise too, probably the worse it gets.
Well, and also if you have a high, super high protein diet on top of a high exercise regimen on top of fasting and no carbs, like you're asking to have a potentially strong negative impact on hormonal function, because the low carb diet, the high fat feeding can bump up SHBG. And then if you're low calorie dieting, you can lower testosterone. And then if you are fasting, you can lower testosterone. And then if you have a high protein intake, you can lower testosterone. So now you have a lower testosterone and then you have a high amount of protein binding all of it up.
Bad combination.
These are things like, again, it has to be set up appropriately, because if it's not set up appropriately, even if you're going to try to do a fasting thing, you can really cause issues for yourself.
And then you were saying too, like it has to do with the metabolism at the tissue and the cortisol metabolism specifically, because you hear like for keto people, oh, cortisol, it goes up initially, but then like after a while it regulates.
So for fasting, cortisol definitively goes up. So they say here, by the way, the paper that I pulled this from is effect of intermittent fasting and this on the circulating levels and circadian rhythms of hormones. So that's the paper. That was for both the thyroid and for the cortisol here. For the cortisol, they say for humans, cortisol begins to increase immediately after fasting commenced. 5-day fasting increases cortisol levels and shifts the peak from the morning to the afternoon. So it actually shifts the time that you get your cortisol peak. Other fasting experiments for 2.5 to 6 days dramatically elevates plasma cortisol levels. Early time-restricted feeding between 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. for 4 days slightly but significantly increases serum cortisol levels in the morning. These results imply that intermittent fasting increases the level and frequency of cortisol secretion. So the fasting itself lowers thyroid and increases cortisol. And again, some of these are comparing to time, like just daily caloric restriction and you don't see some of these same like significant levels of effects. So that's something to keep in mind. It also, like obviously with caloric restriction too, it depends on how much you're restricted. If you're like a 40% deficit, like, yeah, you're going to have cortisol pump. So there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that type of stuff. However, like you also see in some studies that the people are obese or have metabolic dysfunction, they go on these regimens, you generally see that people improve. There are a lot of markers improve because this is where the sticky spot gets into, is losing the body fat better than the stress of being in the deficit. And it's like in a lot of cases, yes, because the body fat has a whole bunch of negative effects at really high levels that can create a bunch of hormonal dysregulation and metabolic dysregulation. So losing it is exceptionally helpful. But the other thing is, this is where you get into this like nuance. It's like, do you have to go to really extreme levels to actually lose the body fat? And also, is there a cost to doing that? And there, number one, there is a cost. And number two is you don't have to go to such massively extreme levels to lose body fat. And again, like we've talked about this in the last episode on how to actually do this, adequate deficit, you're looking at like 20 to 30%, 30% max. If you're leaner, you could go down to 10%. Do it over time. Make sure you have enough protein, that 0.82 grams per pound, enough carbohydrate intake and your carbs and fats are going to be modified based on your caloric target. You have to adjust them. And then from there, what you do is you have adequate resistance training on board and potentially walking or something like this, but at least resistance training to increase and maintain the muscle mass. And then, make sure your micronutrients are topped off. That type of stuff is extremely important, because if you're going to be eating less, sometimes it's hard to hit all your micros. So you don't want to be running micronutrient deficits on top of like massive macronutrient deficits, which skipping breakfast does that. Like, oh yeah, just not going to eat breakfast. It's like, you're okay, I'm just going to miss an entire meal. And if you don't make up for certain things in other meals, you're discussing your regimen was, Ethan, it's not really great long-term for your health.
Like women, everybody, but I think women in particular too, tend to have a harder time hitting the adequate like protein target. So if you are just like limiting the time or meals or whatever that you have to hit the protein target, and it's already hard for you to hit it, you just set yourself up like even worse, you know?
And I wanted to come back really quick just to show what you were saying here. So there's a study here. It's called Low Carbohydrate Diets in Men's Cortisol and Testosterone Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. So I know this isn't women. I know this isn't guys. But this study shows exactly what you're showing. And then they explain why. So they say short term, less than 3 weeks, low versus high carbohydrate diets moderately increase resting cortisol. Whereas long term, greater than 3 weeks, low carbohydrate diets had no consistent effect on resting cortisol. They further say the increase in resting cortisol on short but not long term low carb diets is likely tied to glucocorticoids. So cortisol's role in glucose homeostasis. So maintaining adequate blood glucose levels. Cortisol, glucagon, and gluconeogenesis all increase on short but not long-term low-carbohydrate diets. As glucocorticoids increase gluconeogenesis, the initial rise in cortisol may be partly responsible for a transient increase in gluconeogenesis on short-term low-carb diets. So basically what happens is in that transition phase where you start making ketones, you have to raise cortisol to make sure you have adequate blood glucose because you don't have enough ketones and you need that blood glucose for the central nervous system. Now, and it's both cortisol and glucagon. And then they say, additionally, cortisol may rise to spare glucose for brain function as the brain cannot significantly use fatty acids for fuel. Glucocorticoids inhibit glucose uptake and oxidation in adipose tissue and skeletal muscle, thereby conserving glucose for brain function. So not only do glucocorticoids do that, but glucagon does as well. So glucocorticoids and glucagon are inhibiting your body, your fat tissue and skeletal muscle, to some extent. There's some adjustments to fat tissue and their ability to take up carbohydrate, glucose, while also increasing your liver's production of glucose. And part of that is through breaking down proteins. So that if you're not eating enough protein, is your muscle tissue. So they say, in contrast, endogenous ketone production increases sharply over the first 3 weeks of a very low carbohydrate diet, and ketones can be used for fuel by the brain. Thus, when ketones replace glucose for the majority of brain fuel, cortisol's glucose-sparing effects are not needed, and thus levels may return to baseline. So what happens is ketones bump up, and basically this is like the backup to the backup pathway. So first thing is, if you don't have enough carbohydrate, the first thing your body tries to do is make carbohydrate. And that's through glucagon and cortisol. And that's going to break down the protein coming in from your diet or from your muscle tissues, as well as release a bunch of fats and start shifting your body over to burning fats. And so what's happening is then your body's like, oh, crap, we really still don't have carbohydrate coming in. So now what we're going to do is we're going to start really making ketones so that we don't have to produce so much carbohydrate for the central nervous system. The brain's going to get some ketone and some glucose, and that has a sparing effect on the glucose that we require. Our central nervous systems and some other tissues require on a regular basis. So again, it's the backup to the backup. But also, in order to drive this, again, you're seeing that your muscle tissue and fat tissue and other tissues start to become insulin resistant, again, to still spare that carbohydrate that you are producing for the central nervous system, so it's not being taken up by all these other tissues. And obviously, while the ketones are oxidized differently than regular fatty acids, they're actually oxidized more similarly to carbohydrate than fatty acids in the central nervous system. The other thing that happens, though, is that those are going towards the central nervous system. The other tissues of the body are getting fat because that's what you have. So like in ketosis, this is like you have a whole shift over and you have these backup systems so that you don't basically shred away your lean tissue through gluconeogenesis. But again, like it still comes at like multiple costs because there's like you have to upregulate hormones to release that fat. And you have to change metabolism at the cell and drive a physiologic insulin resistance peripherally or all around the body so that you can maintain the ketones and also the glucose specifically for the central nervous system while everything else gets left with fat. And obviously the difference in fat oxidation versus carb oxidation, I've talked about in other videos, but basically you have a change in the NADH and FADH2 ratio, the NAD to NADH ratio, and then you get more ROS with fat production, which ultimately leads to less CO2 with fat production, which ultimately I'd say was less ideal than carb oxidation, which is why I think the body starts when it gets carbohydrates, like, oh yeah, we're using these carbs. It's like that would be the preferred fuel source. So as soon as you start to get carbs again, the body wants to shift to use carbs, starts to refill glycogen, starts to use a carbohydrate and shut down ketosis. So there's a whole like theory behind it. I know it's a lot, but this is basically this paper described it. But something else to show here is that on ketogenic diets, when you get exposed to a stressor like exercise, you actually have a higher cortisol output. Because so basically what they show here is low versus high carbohydrate diets resulted in much higher post-exercise cortisol after long duration exercise greater than 20 minutes. Now, this was regardless of short-term or long-term. So even in long-term low carbohydrate diet, when you exercise for greater than 20 minutes, you actually increase cortisol output because you have to increase gluconeogenesis a bit. And so they say the results show the increase in cortisol during exercise was greater on low carbohydrate diets. Moreover, this effect appears to persist post-adaptation to a low carbohydrate diet, although somewhat lessened. Interestingly, the rise in post-exercise cortisol was reduced in studies using carbohydrate supplements during exercise on high-carb diets. So carbohydrates in general lower the stress response, lower cortisol. Again, you don't need cortisol to make glucose if you have glucose coming in. So they say this is supported by another meta-analysis which found post-exercise cortisol was significantly attenuated by carbohydrate supplementation during exercise. Thus, it appears to be the rise in cortisol during exercise increased during times of low carbohydrate availability. There are three possible complementary explanations for this. Firstly, as glycogen stores are partially depleted on low carbohydrate diet, cortisol may increase more sharply on low carb diets to facilitate increased gluconeogenesis during exercise. So once you deplete your glycogen stores, the liver, when you exercise, you need glucose. The liver starts to increase gluconeogenesis, and cortisol is involved in that. They say, secondly, fat oxidation is higher on low carbohydrate versus high carbohydrate diets during exercise, and thus cortisol may increase to facilitate increased fat oxidation via inducing lipolysis in fat and adipose tissue. So cortisol has to bump up to help release free fatty acids or fatty acids into the bloodstream to use as a fuel source. Same thing with adrenaline. And all, so adrenaline, cortisol, and growth hormone, which again are all stress hormones. They're not ideal hormones to optimize for. And they say, thirdly, exercise upregulates skeletal muscle glucose uptake. Thus, cortisol may increase preserved glucose for brain function. So the brain still needs some glucose on low carb diets. And basically what's going on is that when you start to exercise, if the muscle starts to soak up some of that carbohydrate, then what winds up happening is that your liver's like, oh crap, we don't have enough carbohydrate for the brain, or the brain's telling the liver, where's my carbohydrate? And then the body's like, all right, cortisol, make some extra carbohydrate for us in this point in time. So if you get put under stress on a low carbohydrate diet, which exercise would be considered a stressor, you increase the glucose demand, then what you may find is that you have a higher cortisol response to stress on these diets, which again, we don't know what the compounding effect of that is over the long term. So that's something to keep in mind. The last one I want to show here, and this is something that you mentioned, Ethan, was high fat, low carbohydrate diet. So this diet was 5% carbs, 66% fat, 29% protein, increases the activity of an enzyme in the tissues called 11-beta-HSD1 while decreasing cortisol clearance via the urine. So 11-beta-HSD1 takes inactive cortisone. So I have an image of this here. So 11 takes inactive cortisone. Here's 11-beta-HSD1, inactive cortisone, and converts it to active cortisol. So you do not want to increase the activity of this enzyme, because now you have active cortisol at the tissue level from this enzyme basically taking the metabolized form, the inactive form, and putting it to the active form. So, and you find this in liver, adipose tissue, lung, and then also immune cells. And so basically what they found in this study, they took six obese men in this low carbohydrate diet, isocaloric. So they said six obese men participated in a similar study with isocaloric feeding. Both high fat, low carb, and medium fat, medium carb diets induced weight loss. So both led to weight loss. They're isocaloric. During, they gave an infusion of a specific type of cortisol. High fat, low carbohydrate, but not medium fat, medium carbohydrate diets increased 11-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 1, 11-beta-HSD1 activity. So basically saw increased rates of appearance of cortisol, and then this metabolite of cortisol, the specific TAG metabolite. And they saw reduced urinary excretion of 5-alpha and 5-beta reduced cortisol metabolites and cortisol clearance. So decreased cortisol clearance, increased conversion to active cortisol. They say high-fat, low-carb diets also raised 24-hour urinary 5-alpha and 5-beta endogenous cortisol metabolites, but did not alter plasma cortisol or diurnal salivary cortisol rhythm. So you're seeing an increased metabolism of cortisol, even though you're not seeing a change in the plasma or the blood. They basically say here to conclude, a low-carbohydrate diet alters cortisol metabolism independently of weight loss. In obese men, this enhances cortisol regeneration by 11-beta-HSD1 and reduces cortisol inactivation by alpha ring reductases in the liver without affecting subcutaneous adipose tissue, 11-beta-HSD1. Alteration of cortisol metabolism may be a consequence of macronutrient dietary content and may mediate effects of diet on metabolic health. So basically what we're seeing here is the high cortisol diet or the low carbohydrate diet, while it didn't change plasma values or blood values of cortisol, even saliva, it changed the metabolism of different cortisol metabolites. So if you're just not looking at it, you're not seeing it because you're not looking at the specific metabolites that get upregulated or the enzyme activity, which again, this goes with the thyroid stuff that we were just talking about, where basically what we see is that the metabolism of the hormones change, even if some of the specific serum values change. So when you're using proxy markers to gauge the effect of something, you need to know that you are using proxy markers that are not the full picture and understand how these things are changing in that context. And again, we can't always look at everything, but it's important to see here, like, okay, so we're seeing an upregulation of conversion to active cortisol and then decreased clearance. So maybe at the tissue level, you're seeing an increased activation of cortisol, even if plasma levels aren't high over all of long-term low-carb dieting. They're just high in the first 3 months. And then when you expose to a stressor, you're seeing an increased cortisol response.
Well, he just kind of says there at the end, like, yeah, your cortisol is fine. But it's like there seems to be a lot that's left out from that picture, because it's like even if you take his explanation that, oh, once you turn into a fat burner and you have these ketones going, like that's what's going to make your cortisol fine. It's like, well, if you want to exercise more than 20 minutes, your cortisol is going to go up. And then it's not accounting for the whole phenomenon that you just walked through, where you're getting the conversion of cortisone into cortisol and a lack of clearance of it, which isn't going to show up on your blood test. So it's important for people to have that context, I think, when they see Berg answer that question.
The other thing is, like, is that rise in cortisol enough to be problematic over the long term? Like, has it reached that threshold? I think it's, we don't exactly know like what the threshold is, but we do know long-term increases in cortisol, like chronic elevations in cortisol cause problems and are associated with a variety of metabolic issues. And also like changes in 11-beta-HSD enzymes are associated with a variety of problems as well. So like, I think the full picture is more indicative of like not an ideal trend, where you see thyroid lowering and cortisol bumping up, and then also androgens and things lowering in men. And then with women, it's variable on the cycle, depending on like where they're coming from. Because they have a lot of PCOS obesity research with fasting, and it shows benefits. But it's like these women have metabolic dysfunction, obese, and they're losing weight. That's like a very different context. And again, like, is that the best way to go about it? Which again, I don't personally think it is. That's my opinion. But, and then this is why I formed that opinion. But yeah, that's basically what it comes down to.
That's the best question to ask. Like, is it worth going this route? Do I have to go this route? And some of the positioning that you hear online is thinking that you have to go this route, and you run into these problems and you're left kind of like, well, what do I do? It's like, there's this whole other way of going about where you can avoid like a lot of the negatives that come along with fasting, ketosis, or whatever else.
To be fair, it's not that these things don't work. It's not that you don't, like, if you're in keto or you're fasting, you're going carnivore. It's not, we're not saying that people don't lose weight and then improve metabolic parameters. They do, 100%. Like, I'm going to say this, I said in the last video, people are like, why are you low carb versus high carb? It's like, look, I'm not saying this stuff doesn't work, guys. The research is clear. Like, these studies are showing that, like, the guys, even in this study with the change in cortisol alteration, like, they still lose weight. It's just that you have these other alterations that occur that are not potentially a good thing. And then even with the fasting, like, the loss in lean mass is really not a good thing. So for me, it's like, can I get people to lose weight without losing their lean mass and without really wrecking their hormonal profile? That's my question. Not like, does keto work or not? Like, I already know it works for people to lose weight. And then when you lose weight, you improve the metabolic markers. Like, that's not a question. We all agree. It's just, what is the downsides to that? And is there a way around it? And I think that there is, and I see it happen with clients, like people who are obese, pre-diabetic, type 2 diabetic, like they can, number one, still have carbs. Number two, they don't have to fast. We do set up an appropriate diet with an appropriate deficit and then engage in weight training, like resistance training. Even if it's at bands at home, that's fine. And they will lose weight, maintain their lean mass, and improve all of their metabolic markers. And without necessarily having a massive negative change in the hormonal profile. And again, like, even if you set up a caloric deficit and you have carbs on board, but it's too hard, too heavy, you still will see negative change in the hormonal profile. Like, it's going to happen because your body is sensitive to the overall fuel supply that it has on a regular basis. So I think these things are like, again, we're not arguing that it doesn't work. It's just like, is there a way that we can set things up to minimize negative hormonal effects while still getting the outcomes over the long term, so that people, when they finish losing their weight, their lean mass is still high. They don't have this like massively negative hormonal profile, and then they can just go back to eating a regular amount of food and move from there. So like, that's the perspective, instead of like this more starvation, more fasting, less carbohydrate intake, smaller eating windows is the way. It's like, I think that this more is better mentality around this, and even the bioenergetic stuff of I'm going to endlessly eat so my metabolism raises. Like, I think both of them have fundamental problems, and it's about finding like, what is that appropriate amount of intervention to get this outcome while minimizing downsides.
Yeah. And it works until it doesn't. Cause a lot of the people that we talk to, right, have like tried these strategies and then kept going. And then it's like, oh, now I'm putting on weight in this with this like small amount of calories, or it just doesn't come off like it used to. And I need like this different approach.
That's why I shifted. When I was doing it at first, I thought it was Nirvana because I saw these changes. And then over time, I started to realize that I was running into problems. And I tried to troubleshoot them in multiple ways, and then I switched it, and then I started to get benefits and feel better. It's like, yeah, this is great. So it's like it was a process of moving through those paradigms and seeing like what worked and what didn't, and then going from there. So again, like there was pros and there was cons. It wasn't completely negative. And there's a lot of things I learned doing those things that I still employ now that are helpful. It's just like not having any carbs and then like having really small eating windows weren't things that I kept, or not eating for like 3 days at a time was not something that I kept because I like didn't think it was a good thing, didn't experience it being a good thing. And when I'm reading the research, I'm also not seeing it being a massively good thing. Like, I'm seeing like some cons with it that I'm saying, maybe it's not worth it.
But I mean, one thing is that you keep from it is like, we're going to have square meals, you know, like that's
three or four square meals a day.
Yeah. Do you want to jump into the next clip with Rhonda?
They're pretty exemplary of the switch in stance after people ran into issues. So I think you're seeing this dynamic play out with some of the major proponents.
I mean, those were the two people who got me into fasting. The first one was Dr. Peter Attia when I saw him on Rogan, And he was really glorifying the fasting stuff and trying to get Rogan to do it as well. And then Rhonda Patrick was like right there too, as well.
Now they kind of like shifted their stance a bit, right? Like Peter was a harder shift than I think Rhonda was. Rhonda's saying like have protein.
Going back to the skipping breakfast where it became like somehow easier for people to just skip breakfast. And that's how they extended their fasting period. You know, for some reason it's like,
right.
Well, maybe you can just shift breakfast over a little bit. So still eat the same amount of meals, right? You're still getting the protein. Because if you skip an entire meal, like you're skipping a lot of protein.
Right, yeah.
And that's where it's like, oh, that's a problem. And then if you're not resistant training on top of that, now there have been studies on time-restricted eating, which is a type of intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
If, at least in women, if they resistance train, they're not losing muscle. So, but you know, the skipping the meal is, I think, the problem where, you know, it's just that became a thing where it's like, yeah, I only eat two meals a day.
And yeah. So,
how are you getting enough protein with two meals a day?
It's not just about the protein, it's protein, there's resistance training, there's micronutrients, and then there's still not a nod to there's some concerns with fasting in terms of, especially longer fast. In terms of the hormonal profile, which we just mentioned, I'm happy that she's talking about it for people so that it's not this thing like, yeah, just miss breakfast and just go from there. You know, if you're talking about like, oh, I have a 14-hour or 12-hour fast or whatever, then the research that I don't think it's necessary. Like you have to do that to lose weight or there's some magical benefits to it. But those don't appear to be quite as like stressful or significant as the longer fasting timeframes, especially for women. I don't see the point of doing that. And even in the study that we talked about, they said here at the bottom, they said the same. So short-term 4 weeks and long-term alternate day fasting diets reduce circulating T3 without any change in TSH. The same result was obtained from another 8-hour time-restricted feeding isocaloric ad libitum within a defined time frame study for 8 weeks. So even with it, if you're on a 16-hour fast, like you can still see negative effects on the hormonal profile. I would like to see discussion of that, but it's nice to see this switch and talking about the importance of lean mass and protein intake.
And then Peter Attia also kind of sings the same tune in his own experience with trying to do the fasting. But I think he says in this clip that he loses like 16 to 20 pounds of muscle mass in that time.
I just took a kind of look at the data, the bigger data of myself, and realized over the course of 3 years, I had lost, I don't remember the exact number, but it was getting close to 20 pounds of muscle. You know, it might have been 16 pounds of muscle over that period of time, because at least at the frequency that I was fasting, which I'm not saying was right or wrong, it's very difficult to gain back the lean muscle you keep losing, right? You lose a ton, you regain some of it. You lose a ton, you regain some of it. But I just couldn't dig out of that hole. And so I think in around 2021, I said, you know what, I'm going to just put the kibosh on fasting for now. And I'm going to make it, I'm going to make sure I gain back 20 pounds of muscle that I have lost. And so that's my personal story with it.
I mean, we talked about this already. I think that if you lost 20 pounds of muscle in 3 years, even though you were resistance training and like eating adequate protein intake, which he was doing from the fasting regimen, I think like study aside, like that gives you quite a bit of information from one of the lead fasting proponents about what like the catabolic nature of fasting. So it's like nice to see the major proponent come out and be like, yeah, like look, I had to switch it up. Because again, like that was the same thing for me. I was doing the fasting and I just couldn't gain weight. I was super lean and I was having a bunch of issues. And I was like, I can't keep doing this anymore. It's not working for me. I need to shift and then run from there. Now, when I tried, to be fair, when I did bioenergetic and I was eating every hour, like when I first came to it, milk and orange juice, that was also absolutely terrible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't like that was the solution. But having like three, like for me, four square meals a day spaced evenly across the day was like a huge boon for my blood sugar and for my mood and for my energy levels and things like this. And also like I remember when I stopped doing the intermittent fasting and keto, I put on muscle so fast. Like I was 175 pounds. And then within like 2 months, I gained some body fat too because my appetite was voracious. But I went up to like 210 pounds and I was getting strong in the gym and I had put on quite a bit of muscle. Like I really... it was a huge shift. And I like at that point, I wasn't even doing super high carb or anything like that yet. I just wasn't doing less than 30 grams a day. And I also wasn't like narrowing the eating window. Like I went to four meals a day. I had adequate protein intake. And then my carb intake was somewhere like 200 grams a day or 250 grams a day. And I still was eating a little bit higher fat. And I felt significantly better. I was sleeping better. I wasn't having like cravings all the time. My stress tolerance was better, and I wasn't as lean, but I was able to put on muscle now. So like it was a huge shift for me to be when I did that. And then I went all the way over to the milk and OJ every hour, and that didn't work. And then I kind of came back to like the four meals a day spaced apart. Because the other thing is like eating all day long, it gave me digestive issues, or eating massive meals if I had too small of a fasting window, as you said, Ethan, also gave me digestive issues. So again, it's like finding what is that optimal level for my setup, for my requirement, and then running with it from there. And it's like took me swinging the pendulum, but I eventually kind of like got it down into this range here instead of going like this.
Yeah. And then you find with clients, like that setup is more sustainable, right? Like instead of adhering to some like very rigid like window of eating, it's like, let's just set the diet up with the square meals, something that's easy, you can prepare it fast, and then we know what your calories are. And if you want to lose weight, then we get the deficit. So that way we're like reaping the benefits that people experience on fasting with weight loss in particular, that's really attributable to the caloric restriction, right? Majorly. Yes. And not having the detrimental hormonal profile and everything like that. I just think when people see Peter Attia kind of the one like going, oh, you know what, I've like slowed down on this, it really does make people like reconsider, because he was kind of the guy, the big proponent of it, that kind of brought it to the whole alternative health stuff. So now him down, and then Rhonda Patrick down. It is a shift. There's a sea change.
I mean, you're seeing a huge shift from all of these, like from the low carb eating to the fasting stuff, like across the board, you're seeing the shift. And like you saw it even with like Dr. Mercola's shift, Paul Saladino shifted, Thomas DeLauer's been shifting like really slowly. Peter Attia shifted in some things, Dr. Rhonda Patrick shifted in some things. So you're definitely seeing a shift in different areas. But I think also part of it, to be fair, for a lot of these people is that they are going through like running some of these things that they're talking about and like reading the research and running it. And then when they're running it, they're saying like, oh, I have to, like, this didn't work out as planned, or like, I have to shift things this way, or I have to shift things that way. And again, like for me, I went through a similar process, so I get it. It's just hard when you have a big like microphone with this stuff and you're like saying like, this is the best thing ever. And then you have to walk back. So like, I also, there is respect for doing that, because it's very difficult. You know, I was straight up about it. So there's respect for doing that. And yeah, I think it's good that it's getting out. Not that it's like, it's absolutely terrible, your body's going to melt. But at the same time, it's like, if you really do like hardcore fast, like your body's going to melt a little bit. Like you're 20 pounds of muscle mass in 3 years if you do like a pretty strong fasting regimen. And so that type of stuff is, it's good to see that, so people can start to hear and say like, oh, okay, like there is some, like there's a pro and a con, and like I kind of can get a gauge of like what the deal is and then move from there.
So I think that wraps it up for today's episode. I don't know if there's anything you want to say before we jump off here.
When anybody's looking into any intervention, whether it's bioenergetic, keto, carnivore, plant-based, and or fasting regimens, to truly get a sense and like look into what the pros and the cons are, and ask yourself, is there another way that I can do this to get the outcome and minimize the risks while maximizing the reward of that setup, and then run from there. And then also understanding like your personal context and what you need in your circumstances is always extremely important. So I'd say those two things. Because those are the things that made a huge difference for me. It's like starting to think about things in that sense, instead of like creating dichotomies of this or that. It's like, no, what is the appropriate amount of this thing? So I started to get more into an individualized sense of things, and then also getting more into the gray area, the specific amount for that particular context.
And then just being honest with yourself too about like what you're experiencing. Because I know there was a period of time where I was doing the stressful dieting, fasting and everything, and I just thought it was the greatest thing because of all the content that I was consuming from the different people. And I was kind of like gaslighting myself and my current health state and stuff. So really taking an audit of how some of the things are going, like sleep, digestion, mood, energy levels and all that. And then maybe getting some lab work to see if any of this stuff like coincides, I think is probably the best plan forward. But with that said, if people want to work with you or find more of your content, where can they go?
They can find me at mikefave.com.
All right.
And what about you, Ethan?
I'm on Twitter at Ethan_Wright7, and same on Instagram.
Awesome.
All right. Perfect. We'll see you guys next week.